Thank you, Brian. And tonight, our main speaker is Cody. Please give him a warm welcome.
All right. Good evening, everybody. My name is Cody. I'm an alcoholic. I want to start off with the usual. I want to thank Tom for inviting me to speak tonight. It's an honor and a privilege. Any opportunity I get to tell my story, share my experience, strength, and hope. I did thank Tom. I want to thank Andrew for being my 10-minute. Coming out. Thank you for that. I want to thank Billy and Matt and Stan for setting up the meeting. Without you guys, we wouldn't be able to do this thing. So my hat's off to you. Thank you. If I was wearing one. Okay. My sobriety date is December 12th, 2013. I think I have 22 months of continuous sobriety now, and 24 hours of time. I might make it to 2 years this around Christmas time. I'm pretty excited about that. My sponsor, his name is Carlo L. from San Francisco. He has a sponsor as well. I work the steps. I've worked the steps with several different sponsors. I'm finally in a place now with the guy that I'm working with that I feel like he's a good balance between the last two sponsors that I had. I felt like one was very rigid and the other one was too lenient. And I'm very happy right now with where I'm at with my program. When I came into the program, I went to meetings every day, sometimes two, sometimes three. I did the 90 and 90, which I think was more like 120 and 90. I got a sponsor when I walked into my first AA meeting, and I stayed with that man until I too moved. It just worked out for me. The geographic thing worked out to me that Andrew talked about. That worked out for me because I needed to get away. It wasn't that I didn't bring my mess with me, because I did, but I was in quicksand where I was. Everyone around me drank and used like I did, and like Andrew said again, not the caveat on everything he said, but man, he told my story, because every time I went to a party or some gathering, it could be a family gathering, I thought we were there to get messed up. You know, I thought that was what we were there for. You know, so real quick, I mean, I'm going to briefly touch on what it used to be like. I want to keep it short, though, because I really want to talk to you guys about what alcohol did for me, not so much what I did on alcohol. You guys have all done that. That's why you're here. So, you know, I started drinking young. I don't know for sure what my first drink was. I know one of my first drunks. I know I got really wasted and woke up completely hungover and lied about having the flu on a Thanksgiving thing that we'd broken into the grandparents' liquor cabinet, and everyone knew we were drunk, but it was just like, oh, boys will be boys. You know, my cousins and I, and it wasn't a big deal, but I think I was 13 or something when that happened, and that wasn't, you know, that probably wasn't even the first time. I think I remember stealing Zimas from my parents' refrigerator. You know, my parents weren't drinkers, so just a backstory, if you're wondering, if it's genetic, I don't know. I'm adopted, and my parents didn't drink. So, my adopted parents didn't drink. My birth mom, she does, still. So it might have been genetic. I don't know. I think it had more to do with my inability to accept life on life's terms. Like I mentioned just now, I was adopted at birth, so the feeling of being different, I like to avoid going there, but I always go there when I tell my story. I always say I felt different. You know, I remember when we were in elementary school or something, we would talk about our heritage. And I would make up the most extreme stories. I mentioned I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a liar, a cheat, and a thief. You know, one of the things I used to do was lie. I'd lie for no reason. I didn't know my parents. So I'd make up this elaborate story that I was maybe, if Native American was cool that year, I was Native American. If it was cool to be black, I had some black in me. Who knows? It didn't matter. The point was, I was a young boy terrified to be who he was. I was adopted to a really awesome family, and that wasn't good enough, you know? I said that I wanted to talk about what alcohol did for me. You know, I can tell you guys right now that I have little man complex. Andrew has this great quote on his email when he sends out emails that says, "I'm not what you think I am. I'm not what I think I am. I'm what I think you think I am." And that's that right? That's right, right?
Yeah.
Sounded good.
Yeah.
So that's me, man. I am what I think you think I am, which allows me, which actually is a cool chameleon act, because when I'm with you, I can get along with everybody. You know, and they say that this is a group that wouldn't normally mix, but I beg to differ, because if we were in a bar, we'd all get along, you know, until we didn't. And that's my drinking. That's what alcohol does for me. It lets me get along with you until it no longer works like that. And then I want to kill you. Or have sex with you. Depends on what you're doing. The birthplace of innovation and change, the thing that made me change, where I changed, was when I got vulnerable. It took me a long time. I came in when, I know that some of us come in here later than others. I came in when I was 28, and I was vulnerable. Like many of us, I had wrecked relationships. I had ruined a career. I was facing a prison sentence, and I had set new bottoms for myself so many times that I didn't even know where I was gonna stop. And some of us have to die, you know? Unfortunately, that's the reality of this disease, and some of us have to die, because those bottoms, then they're glass, you know? We can just keep shattering through another one, and then whatever. I hate to hear that, and I hate to share that message, you know, because really, my message should be light. It should be, this thing worked for me. I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous on a court card when I was 14 years old, after I'd been, maybe right before I got expelled from my high school, for drinking and fighting. I had really nothing going for me, so I joined the military. My brother-in-law likes to point that out. You had nothing going for you, that's why you joined the service. No, that's not entirely true, and it's definitely not true for all veterans, but I had nothing to do. I was not going anywhere. And I did some time in the Marine Corps. I had some really positive, or what could have been some really positive experiences, but because of my obsession with alcohol and alcoholism, 4 years was a blur. I've seen Thailand, Australia, Singapore, Dubai, UAE, Iraq, the little one next to it, Kuwait, you know, Syria and Jordan. And I can only tell you about the really negative things that happened in all those places. I can't tell you anything, any of the positives. You know, one of the things about my memory, and I think this is similar for most humans, most of the human experience, is that a negative emotion or feeling or memory requires a lot of brain space. And so those are the ones that I hang on to, which is why I can't remember my first drink, because it was probably freaking awesome. That's why I drank for so long. But I remember each and every one of the negative ones and how bad they affected me afterwards. You know, but none of that was enough to get me sober. None of that was enough for me to be vulnerable. None of that was enough for me to get in here and say, I don't know how to live life. Help me. That's hard for anyone to do. And I tip my hat to you if you have done that or are thinking about doing that. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the most, it's one of the most incredible places where you can find a bunch of people trying to improve their lives. And I had never found that anywhere else. One of the things One thing specifically that I remember, and I want to tell you a story about a feeling about alcohol and the way that it was awesome for me, or one thing that how it affected me. I had this thing, this other disease called FOMO, which is the fear of missing out. And if you're doing something that I think might be cool, I want to be there no matter what it is. If you're going to a bonfire in the woods, I want to be there. If you're going to a party at someone's house, I want to be there. If you're going to the bar, I want to be there. Like, something different might happen this time. And my fear of missing out and my alcoholism would do what my wife used to say, is keep the party going. I could never let the party stop. If I was drinking on Thursday night, it would last until Sunday night. And I'm a binge drinker, and I black out. Sometimes I black out quickly, sometimes I black out slowly, but it will always materialize if I work at it. And it did. It did. I would get to my blackout. That was what I was going for, because I felt like in a blackout, if I punched you in the face and didn't remember it, it didn't really happen, you know, or whatever. And I did that, you know. You know, I can remember I went to a Giants game with my best friend, and we'd been drinking early in the morning. Now, we're not even 18 years old at the time. The idea was that we were going to drink on the ferry over there and have a great time at the game and whatnot. And I remember after a couple of drinks, I don't remember how many I'd had, but I'd had a few, enough to feel good. I was at that point that we try and get to. I felt great. I walked into the bathroom, and I rolled up my sleeves, and my forearms were looking muscular, and I was feeling all buff. And I was like, yeah, alcohol made me grow a couple inches, made me a little bit more slim in the face, maybe handsome, you know, gave me my hair, you know, all these things that, you know, I thought that you guys wanted me to be, I became that when I got to that point. But then I tried to chase that point, and I always went over it, always. I cannot tell you one time that I went out, got there, and stayed there. Not one time. You know, if I got there, if some is good, then a lot is better. So I would try and get really there, you know. And what ended up happening is I went into the Giants game in a blackout. This is during Barry Bonds' home run race. He knocked a homer. I missed it, stood up the next inning when no one was up to bat, and started screaming, yeah, for the home run. The guy next to me told me to sit down, and I punched him in the face. And then I jumped the banister and ran. And I passed out on Embarcadero in San Francisco, and I think I was maybe 17. That could be the way that I could describe any and every one of my drinking experiences. Something that could be awesome, totally ruined by my desire to get further there. I refused to come into Alcoholics Anonymous on the court card. I came here, I sat in the back. I wouldn't look you in the eyeballs. I couldn't look you in the eyeballs. I didn't want to be anything like you guys. I listened to the messages. I even went to book studies because I could get my court card signed there and they wouldn't hassle me to talk. But I heard some things. I remember distinctly, before I was 18, I had said something like, if I ever become an alcoholic, I'll go there, right? And fast forward through all those different experiences that I kind of passed over, I had lost my career. I was living in my father's basement. I was 28 years old. My wife was considering leaving me, like I said, I was facing a jail sentence for assault with a deadly weapon during a blackout. And I was done. And I wasn't done drinking. No. I was done living. You know, Andrew talked about that tonight, and I appreciate that he did, because, you know, alcohol was not my problem. Alcohol was a symptom of my problem. Alcohol was and is the scapegoat to my me problem. I hate me, you know, or I did, you know. I hated everything that I'd become, every bottom that I set for myself that I surpassed, and I hated that about myself. I was carrying so many rocks. We talk about dropping the rock in here. I had so many rocks in my pack from negative experiences that I think my pack straps were on the verge of breaking, and that was how I ended up suicidal and vulnerable. And I walked into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I remember, I'll never forget my first meeting back, I guess we could call it that. I was sitting in the corner, but in the front. I didn't know what to do. My now sponsor was sitting next to me, and he suggested that I raise my hand and introduce myself as a newcomer. Now, that took some courage, but at the time, I didn't need courage. I was desperate. And the big gift of desperation, what that means for me is that when I don't know what to do, I'll do anything. If you tell me that picking up cigarette butts outside will help me stay sober, and I'm desperate to stay sober, then I'll pick up cigarette butts. I don't smoke, but I'll pick up cigarette butts. If you tell me that raising my hand and saying, I'm new and I don't know what to do, will help me stay sober, then I'll raise my hand and I'll sheepishly not look you in the eyes and say, I'm new and I don't know what to do. And that's what I did. I said, I'm new, I'm alcoholic, I'm probably a drug addict, I'm suicidal, I'm at an end, and they were just like, okay, welcome, whatever. and I wasn't offended. I was too, high to care. But what ended up happening was the meeting was apparently a good one. I didn't know what a good one was at the time. But a woman came up to me after the meeting, and she handed me her big book, and she said, you need this more than I do, and walked away. And the reason I tell that is because the book that she handed me, I don't know if that was her, someone had done the same thing for her, but she had just finished sharing a few seconds earlier that her child died in her arms because she was too loaded to follow the instructions of the 911 operator when she called 911 because her kid was not breathing. And when she handed me her book, I thought to myself, I think, are you sure? I need this more than you. And, she didn't even hesitate, just gave it to me and walked away. I don't know what happened to that woman. But frankly, I think that a culmination of events that happened without my understanding saved my life. I think her giving me that book and the importance of that book and the humanity in that book saved my life because I opened it and I read it. And, consequently, on the front page, there's a bunch of women's numbers. So I had to cross those out to get started. So that was interesting. But what went above it was my sobriety day. That was what I did on my first day. I scratched out women's phone numbers and put my sobriety date in the first page of a big book. And I started this journey and I started reading. I read through Bill's story and I found a lot of things I could relate to, ironically, even though, he was a stock analyst or a company analyst for a stock brokerage in New York in 1935. And I was living in my dad's basement, but we were both former military. So I first was attracted to that. I was like, okay, Bill recognized this sign about whether a grenadier who died by musket or by pot, blah, blah. There were all these things that just jumped off the page to me. On page 11, I want to say, or maybe 9, I don't know, he talks about Jesus. Because I had a problem with Jesus when I came in here. And he said, to Jesus, I'm not good at this, but something to the effect of a great man with great teachings. But he doubted the world religions had done any good for mankind. And I was like, yes, I feel the same way you do, Bill. a bunch of other things. Because I came in here as an atheist or an agnostic or somewhere in between where I was kind of like, I didn't know, but I was like, I don't care if you know and blah, blah, blah. But that wasn't the truth. The truth was I was envious of people that were raised on religion. I wasn't raised with that. So people and their moral teachings, to me, I was like, whatever, dude, you're weak. You're weak-minded. You're weak-willed. You're weak in every manner of the weak sense. You need something stronger to latch onto. That was what I was preaching. And I came in here and you guys told me you don't have to have our God, their God, anyone's God. Get your own God. And I was like, well, I can't even fathom the word God. So someone broke it down super shotgun style for me. They said, God. A group of drunks. And I was like, that doesn't work. God, good orderly direction. Aha, that works. What the hell does that mean? Well, I have two sides on my shoulders, right? I have the Jiminy Cricket that's telling me to always let my conscience be my guide and to do the right thing. And then I have the other side that's telling me to get messed up or telling me who cares or it doesn't matter if you hurt their feelings or you can throw trash out your window or you can curse at a group level or, you know, F that, F this, whatever, who cares? That's that side. And that side's still there. It's always going to be there, I imagine. It definitely comes when I'm in moments of weakness, which also occur on a regular basis. I mean, I'm a human being. I'm a human being who lived my life the same way for 28 years. I mean, I was aggressive, egotistical, prideful, a liar, a cheat, and a thief, as I've already talked about. Like, that's what I did, and that's what I resort to when I'm in moments of weakness. I want to go back to that. I want to hurt you more than you hurt me. I want to get angry at you because you are somehow affecting me. You know, I find something about you so unflattering that I hate you. You know, and, you know, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous teaching me things like love and tolerance and patience and kindness and to pause and to walk the talk and practice what I preach and, for example, I want to use this as an example. And I don't know if any of this makes sense, any sense at all. It probably doesn't, which is cool, because then I'm telling the truth. Tom told me, what are you doing on Saturday? I'd like to have you speak. And I told you guys I have FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. Well, this is an opportunity for me to share my experience, strength, and hope. Everybody's going to want to hear this awesome message. You know, I got almost 2 years, so I know a lot. You know, I know what I know, but whatever. You know, they're going to want to hear this. And I didn't say yes, did I, Tom? I said, let me think about it. I'll get back to you. Let me check with the people that mean the most to me. Let me check with my sponsor. Let me talk to my wife. Let me ask my sponsees if they'll go with me. Let me follow up before I say yes to something just on the cuff. I don't do cuff anymore. Cuff gets me in trouble. Cuff means I'm running the show. So I did all those things. I called my sponsor. I called my wife. You know, they said, is this going to be a grave inconvenience to you or to your family? And I said, no. And they said, is this an opportunity for you to be of service? I said, yes. And they said, well, it sounds like a win-win. Can you do it? And I said, yes. And so I called Tom back the next morning, and I said, yes, Tom, I'll do it. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, the privilege. You know, that's the difference that Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps has done in my life. That's one of them, one of the many. I mean, I could tell you 100. I can sit here, I can sit before you and tell you that when I came in here, I was on a fail card, man. I was losing at life. You know, I had, like I said, a pending felony, and as a result of that pending felony, I was pissed. I was pissed that I had gotten caught. You know, and that I was guilty of a crime against humanity. And because of you guys, I tried something different. It took me 3 years, but I tried something different. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I sat there in that courtroom when the prosecutor said about Mr. Cowan's atrocities, you know, the criminal nature of his acts. You know, I sat there with my left hand on my left knee and my right hand on my right knee, and I smiled in the courtroom, and I held the door for the police officers, and I talked to the homeless guy sitting next to me that was really pissed off about being there. And we had a good chat. And within 2 months, that case was dropped. And I had everything to be thankful for. And it was directly because of my sponsor saying, you owe these people. We found your part in this. When I worked the 12 steps, and I went through step 4, and I went to step 5, and I confessed what I had done, I was like, this guy did it to me. And he was like, what was your part? And I was like, nothing, dude, nothing. I was standing there when he said, where'd you get that cowboy hat? And I said, from your mother. You know, I'm a victim here. Don't you see it? Nobody sees it. Then what'd you do? I stabbed him. Because I was drunk. Would you have done that sober? No, I wouldn't have done that sober. And then what'd you do? I ran. And then what'd you do? I cried, and I went to jail, and my life changed, and it's all these things. The fifth step for me, and I've shared this before, if you were in my home group at the Thursday Night Men's Stag, I remember distinctly sharing that my fifth step was uncomfortable. My fifth step, I ripped a big bandage off of myself, and there was a gaping wound exposed, and it was unpleasant to look at and to share with another man. I mean, maybe your bottom's too low for me, and maybe my bottom's too low for you, or maybe vice versa, or maybe the opposite. Maybe you can't believe I got sober when I did. But for me, I was defeated. I was defeated, deflated. I don't know another D word that crushes people, but I was crushed, man. I came in here as my sponsor used to say, a self-made failure, man. I reaped what I sowed at the time. You know, and I didn't know how to do anything different. One of the things that I talk about with my guys now is we're always chatting about the tools, right? The tools that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. One of the biggest tools that I've gotten since coming into Alcoholics Anonymous is writing. And I don't even do enough of it. But when I do, it always has such a profound effect for me. And it started when I worked my very first step. I had to write about what the first step meant to me. Which, you know, when I work with other guys on the steps, you know, I don't necessarily do that. But that was the way it was introduced to me the very first time. And I've done my steps with several different men now, so I've gotten a couple of different ways to do it. And I kind of taken what I liked from those ways or things that had effect on me, and I wrote about it, and I started to write, and I think that's probably where I got the most vulnerable. One story that I like to share is when I was doing my ninth step amends. I'd written my eighth step, and it was a list that I had prepared when I wrote my fourth, minus a few that I had harmed that didn't harm me. And on that list, one of the people that was very important to me was my mother, and she had passed away 1 month prior to me being involved in that assault case. And so I was angry and hurt and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I had a resentment against my mom for dying, which I never even thought that was possible. But I was pissed that she left me, you know. When I wrote my amends letter to the deceased, I didn't think much of it. In fact, I made columns on my ninth step for people that I thought were going to be easy amends, people that I thought were going to be a little bit more challenging, people that I were never willing to ever look them in the eyeballs and say, I did this to you, I'm sorry. Never would I ever do that. So I had those three columns, and my mother was in the list of people that were going to be easy amends. And I put off writing the amends for a couple of weeks, and it was a subconscious thing. It was not a conscious decision. I just said, I'll get to it later. Even though my sponsor kept saying, how's that writing going? How's that writing? And, you know, and I was like, God, enough. I don't stop it. And when I wrote the amends, again, I shared in my writing in a general way, which was weird because for writing, you can write free. You know, writing is very freeing for me because I can say exactly what I'm thinking. You know, and sometimes it gets a little jarbled, but who cares? The real message is in there, you know. And I started to write, and I think I wrote a good few pages, which was not unlike the other writings that I'd done for an amend. And we were headed to a meeting that I was, in fact, we were heading to this meeting. And I was speaking for the first time, and I think I had 10 months of sobriety, which is ironic because now I have a year and 10 months, I think. So. Well, I mean, I do, but I think that it's about that same time. Anyway, I was going to share the amends with my sponsor prior to coming to the meeting. And my sponsor was like, are you sure that's a good idea? And I was like, yeah, man, this is no big deal. I distinctly remember saying that. So we sat down in his backyard, we pulled up a third chair, and we invited God into the discussion or the talk. And I started reading, and I think I made it like four words in. I didn't even hit the first period yet. And I was bawling. And I was crying harder than I had cried since she died. You know, this woman adopted me from birth. She couldn't have kids biologically. So, you know, she was lucky to get an adoptee. And I was lucky enough to be adopted by an educated, loving woman. and she taught me how to be a good person. And it was totally lost on me because I was in those years of anger, resentment, teenage years, rage, and then followed up by abruptly by alcoholism. My mother never saw me sober. And that sucked. Because all she ever wanted was for me to get help. Because she knew that I was an alcoholic from the first time I got loaded. She knew my story better than I know my story. And there was one distinct thing that I did drunk. And this is the kind of alcoholic that stands in front of you. I got loaded with my buddies. It was the same week that Fight Club, the movie with Brad Pitt, had come out. And we thought we were going to start our own Fight Club. And we got into a fight on the deck. And we were bloodied. It was just headbutts and punching, and probably could have killed one of us, but who cares? We were drunk. And she came home from work. She worked at a hospital. She was a nurse. And she came home to find her son and his three friends covered in their blood, passed out from being drunk. And I stood up when she woke me up. I was a little pissed off and in a blackout still, and I spit bloody sputum in her face. And I told her that she wasn't my mom. And that, I wish I could tell you that that was the first time that had happened, or the last. But that's the kind of alcoholic I was. I didn't care, you know, about anything or anyone when I was drinking. And that's not the case today. You know, when I wrote that amends, it was the hardest thing I've ever done, and I didn't know it. And I also started from that moment on to develop a relationship with a higher power that I choose to call God. And because I believe it has something to do with this good orderly direction thing, I break it down shotgun style like that for you guys when I talk about it. You know, God was watching out for me through my entire life from, I could say, arguably, my birth on, because I was adopted, you know. And what an amazing thing to have something, some power greater than yourself working in your life that you don't understand or care about. You know, and I truly believe today that the reason I survived all of the different things that I survived and the reason that I'm standing here today is because I am suited, unlike some others, to be helpful to alcoholics. Because those stories that I've talked about tonight, as ugly and as just, you know, and as much as I don't want to stand in front of you guys and tell you these things about myself, they're my story, and what they are today is they're gold for the newcomer. You know, shockingly enough, I have met people in this program that have the exact same story as me, and some of them are newer in recovery than I am. And that makes me equipped to handle their stuff. You know, you guys taught me to put my hand out. And because of that, I know probably 90% of the people in this room. We are not alone, you know. Somebody has gone through it before us. That's the amazing thing, you know. That's how this has worked for me, and that's how I think it will work for anyone else. Is, you know, we share these stories, these things that I don't want to tell anyone that stuff. But every time I do, I feel a little bit better, man. Honestly, what we got? Alarm? Everybody good? Right on. Cool, so that was a little bit too heavy. I'm going to tone it down for the last little bit here. So you know, I haven't exactly talked about which step I was on at which point and which time and stuff, but the reality of it is I worked my steps in order, and every once in a while I was introduced to a new step by default out of order, and it worked out for me. What I mean by that is I was doing 10 steps when I wasn't on my 10th step, and that was because I was in between the 8th step and the 10th step, and something came up, and it needed to be added to my list of things, and I need to find my partner, and I need to do it immediately before I get loaded over it. And so there were occasions where it was necessary for me to do 10th step when I wasn't on my 10th step. But once I was on my 10th step, the difficulty was finding some stuff on my side of the street because I had cleaned it. You know, but don't worry, I'm an alcoholic who's not drinking. I went out there and pissed off some people and got pissed off and found some things to put on a 10 step. And I worked those 10 steps and then I moved on to my 11th step, which asked me to practice prayer and meditation. The guy who said that it's weak to pray and it's if you're meditating, you obviously like yoga and you are not for me. I had to practice something different, man. And what happened was profound. I had incredible experiences with prayer and meditation. And I shared this before. It sucks that this was my experience, but I didn't know exactly how to pray. I hung on to the third step prayer up until step 11. And that one worked for me. And I said that before I came in here, and I said that when I was sitting there listening to Andrew speak. Because that gets me outside of myself and out of my way. But I learned how to pray, to really pray, by watching an episode of The Sopranos. And I've said this before, but it's true. I was watching Mrs. Soprano pray for her nephew, who had been shot several times in a gangland-style execution. And the way that she prayed for someone else to have everything that she wanted is one of the things that we talk about when we talk about forgiveness and when we talk about acceptance. We talk about praying for that other person that we're angry at or that we have a resentment towards for 2 weeks, and we talk about praying for everything that we want for them, not what they want, what we want for them. You know, and I've done that multiple times now, and every time it's had an amazing effect, because if I write down what I'm angry at and I look at it on paper, it usually looks pretty silly. Then when I pray for them to have the things that I want, which also equally seem pretty silly, it's a really cool effect that I don't necessarily hate that person anymore or want to do them harm like I did before. And then step 11 for me, I mean, I think on the Central Coast and Southern California, we talk about the 10, 11, and 12 being, you know, living steps that we practice every day, and I think I tend to agree with that, because I know that if I'm doing those three things, clearing the new wreckage that I make, prayer and meditation and working with others, when I do all three of those things, my life is so blessed. You know, Step 12, I've heard so many different ways to approach step 12. I don't know if there's one right way or even if there is a wrong way. I don't know. Some people are gifted in sponsorship. Some people are really good sponsors. Some people are really good speakers. Some people are really good at setting up the chairs. Not everyone's equipped to set up the chairs. Some people are good greeters. I'm a greeter. I love that job. I mean, yeah, I made the mistake one time of saying, I don't want to be a greeter because I don't know any of these people. And they were like, that's why you're the greeter. And I was like, damn it. You know, but I do now. I know just about everyone at South County Speaker Meeting because of that greeter commitment that I had for 2 years, you know, or a year and a half. You know, and it's like if I'm willing to do something that someone else in AA asked me to do, it almost always turns out right. I haven't had a case that I can say it isn't always, but since Bill put that in our text, I think I'll say almost always. You know, almost always it works out for the better. And luckily for me, Alcoholics Anonymous has a lot of things that need doing. So they, you know, I've been asked to do things. And you know, sponsorship for me, if you're fairly new or haven't sponsored someone, haven't had the experience of watching the steps take form in someone else's life, man, I implore you to try that. Because whether it works for them or doesn't, it forces me to go through my steps again with them. when I'm sitting opposite the table and we've pulled that third chair up for God and we're talking about fifth step and they're revealing to me their deepest, darkest secrets, the things they are taking to their grave, I get to share mine. And it makes those secrets a little less powerful, man, because they say in here that we're only as sick as our secrets, and when I came in here, I had so many dang secrets, I couldn't tell the secret from the truth. You know, and still that gray area is there if I choose to walk it, you know, if I choose to live in that. If I want to go there, I can go there easier than it is than I find it for me to tell you the truth. I mean, I'd just as soon lie to you. Yeah, that's some pretty powerful stuff right there. It's weird, but it's like a protective mechanism for me, you know. And you know, 90% of the time, if I keep my mouth shut, I won't lie.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, I'm grateful to the way the steps were set up and the way that we work them in order and the fact that we have a textbook to read, you know. One of the things that I did recently because of Eileen in the front row was I went to a Back to the 40s book step study, and it was because you talked about it, and I'm grateful that you talked about it because I when I went to that, and I'm now encouraging one of my sponsees to do that, it had an incredibly strong... what is it? Jerry, help me out here.
Yeah.
It was like intense, man. It was intense. It was something I'd never experienced before. I had said the third step prayer with another man holding hands in Denny's at 2 in the morning. I talked about this, Brian. I'd done that, and that was, whoa, this is so intense. But when I said it in a room full of men, or when we went around the group and all admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable individually one at a time, you know, and we talked about our stuff in the fourth step. And I mean, I felt like I had been transported back in time to before smartphones and FaceTime with my sponsor when I do my book study with him. You know, before that, I was in a room full of guys desperate. Man, it was cool. It was like being on that sinking ship. So if you have not tried a Back to the 40s step study or book study, or I don't know what it's called, just Back to the 40s, man, that's what it is. We go back to the way they did it in the old days. It was cool. I implore you to try that. So, you know, basically what I'm saying is get a sponsor, work the 12 steps, get into service with others, specifically alcoholics, and try something new. Try something you may not have done on your own. Something that might have been suggested to you, because had it not been for the suggestions that I got in here, I wouldn't have what I've got today. I've got some incredible stuff. I have found out, and not to toot my own horn, but this is the only opportunity I get to toot, I have got some skills that I never in a million years knew I had. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a veteran, I was a fighter, I was nothing nice. What I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I'm sensitive, I'm vulnerable, I have feelings, and they matter to both me and the people around me. That I can say those things and be vulnerable and not be afraid of the consequences, you know. You know, I'm not what you think I am anymore. I'm not what I think you think I am anymore. All right. Not anymore. No, now I'm into math. I'm kind of a geek. I like video games. I don't like violence. I'm happy. I'm totally in love with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because now I'm not always serene and peaceful, but I get these snippets of it, you know, and I get these moments of pause we talk about, you know, and some brief moments of clarity, and I too had that garden variety spiritual experience, but that's okay, man, you know, that's exactly what needed to happen for me. I am absolutely ecstatic to be here. You know, and I mean not just here in this room tonight. I mean just on this earth, man. There is so much beauty that I was missing by being loaded. and I was loaded a lot. So, you know, I want to again thank all the people that had something to do with this meeting tonight. And if you talked to me before the meeting and you came here because I talked to you, thank you too. Thank you for showing up for me. I appreciate that. Like I said, you know, man, it is an honor and a privilege to stand up in front of you guys, you know. With as little time as I've got and as little that I know, it is a privilege to be here tonight. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks.
Okay, let's give Andrew and Cody another round.